From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his fabled State of the Union address in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson set the wheels of government to war on poverty in America. In 1988, President Reagan famously responded that poverty had won that war and hailed a free market strategy as the solution. Many Americans simply looked away. Hurricane Katrina made looking away impossible. There was a scene of wrenching poverty on display for the country and the world, shaming abject poverty. So what now? What is to be done? This hour on Point, American poverty and what to really do about it. You can join the conversation. If the war on poverty fell short and the Republican market-driven revolution fell short, what is the answer here? What are you prepared to do to support to tackle American poverty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We turn first this hour to the scene of the Katrina wake-up call. Gwen Filosa covers poverty for the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. She joins us from Baton Rouge. Gwen, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
So take us into what were we really seeing there when we saw these just kind of mind-blowing scenes from New Orleans? People now say, oh, well, we should have known it. It's been there all along. But when the country looked down to the Gulf after Katrina had blown through and saw this poverty, what was that a piece of?
Again, it's people I've been interviewing and talking to for years, and what you saw were a lot of single women with children and a lot of families that are really struggling in the worst types of poverty in New Orleans, and I would call it extreme American poverty. People with no health care, no anything, and living in substandard housing, doubled up with families, just people really struggling.
Now, when we look at the numbers nationally, and they came out, the latest ones, just before Katrina hit, Gwen, you saw 12.7% poverty in 2004. That included 8% of American whites in poverty. And poverty here defined as an income of $19,300 for a family of four. 8% of American whites, 22% of Hispanics, nearly a quarter of all African Americans. What about in Louisiana?
Oh, in Louisiana, the breakdown, we're the poorest state in the country. And what you're seeing is also, in Louisiana statewide, half of the children who live in Louisiana households are below the poverty line.
Half, 50% statewide.
It's a lot of kids, and 30% of all the kids in Louisiana are just outright living in destitution. I mean, and in Orleans Parish made up a huge percentage of that, and it's children struggling with in poverty.
Those are incredible numbers, 50% and 30% in destitution, as you say. What has the conversation been? I know you all have had your hands full down there since Katrina and Rita came through, but what's the conversation that's emerging here? You've reported on a new coalition taking aim at poverty in your area. What kind of approach, what kind of thinking is going on there now?
You're referring to Governor Blanco's coalition to attack poverty, in their words. And now, I mean, we have a city that's just empty. All of the public housing developments have been declared uninhabitable, and those people have been moved a lot to Houston, a lot to Texas, all over the country. People in Utah. I don't know. The city now is just so struggling to have people come back to live with the. Potable water right now.
So there's a dispersal, but not a solution. And as you say, the problem in Louisiana is statewide, and we're looking at it nationwide in our conversation today. Is there a new approach that's bubbling up out of this situation, or are people just struggling with the immediate aftermath at this point?
Well, things have just gotten worse for a lot of people in Louisiana. I mean, what I've been reporting on is the fact we have 47,000 people still in shelters in Louisiana, living in the Cajun Dome in Lafayette, and people who were never poor before Katrina. So now we have a kind of this added class of people who all of a sudden are poor, and people are just, and then 300,000 families have been dispersed around the state and the country. It's just it's almost like other states are going to absorb a lot of these poor people. And people have found success in cities like Houston and Dallas. They found great success.
So far, at least, in getting themselves
a
roof over their heads and getting back on their feet just a little bit. But it sounds as though you're still kind of up to your neck in it all there, and with a long history of poverty, even before the storm blew in. Gwen, thanks for giving us the current picture there. We appreciate your being with us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you, Tom.
Gwen Filosa, reporter covering poverty for the Times-Picayune. I'm joined in the studio now by William Julius Wilson. He's professor of sociology and social policy at Harvard University, director of the Joblessness and Urban Poverty Research Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, author of When Work Disappears. William Julius Wilson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. I am also joined in the studio by Thomas Shapiro, professor of law and social policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He is author of The Hidden Cost of Being African American, How Wealth Perpetuates Inequality. Thomas Shapiro, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to look at this very broadly to begin with and then try and get down to some new perspectives here if we can find them. William Julius Wilson, first to you, if I may. We've framed this as, all right, we had the war on poverty. It wasn't fully executed. Nevertheless, it had some time and it had its successes and its failures. They've been famously discussed. We have had the Republican Revolution and its kind of market solution to everything. And still we see the poverty post-Katrina. We read these numbers. Where do we stand now? Is there a new understanding of how to approach this? Where are you seeing us in this arc of trying to confront and failing poverty?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you said that the war on poverty had some successes. It's not true that entirely true that we had a war on poverty and poverty won. You know, I think it's important for Americans to realize that there's been a dramatic decrease in poverty among Americans age 65 and over, and that's associated with the Medicare program that Johnson introduced as one of his great society programs. So I wanted to emphasize that. But I think it's really very, very important to place a discussion of poverty in a broader conversation that deals with economic inequality, growing economic inequality in American society. We should have a historical perspective on this. For example, when talking about rising inequality, it's important to remember that from 1945 to roughly 1970, early 1970s, a rising tide did indeed lift all boats. All income groups experienced economic advancement, including the poor. Indeed, the poor were becoming less poor, not only in relative terms, but in absolute terms as well.
And yet among African Americans, we had 35.7% poverty in 1983.
Yeah, that's 1983. But there was a gradual decline of poverty among African Americans during this period from the mid-1940s to the early 1970s.
And yet Lyndon Johnson was declaring war on poverty in 1964.
Yeah, well, he declared war on poverty in 1964 when poverty at that time was in decline. That's fine.
Push it on down, right.
Push it on down, you see. Mm-hmm. It's important to realize that after the early 1970s, rising inequality took hold, a widening gap between the haves and have-nots in American society.
Does that mean we're slicing the pie wrong? Does that mean you're suggesting it's back to a government solution, reallocate the country's resources through government intervention?
I'm not suggesting reallocate resources in terms of government intervention. What I'm trying to get us to recognize that we have a significant problem that's affecting broad segments of the American population, and poor people represent one part of that population, and that we should have programs that are designed to attack the rising inequality.
Tom Shapiro, you've got solutions as well, but give us first your sense of where we stand in our kind of understanding of the challenge here, now illuminated by these terrible images from Katrina that have woken us all again.
I would first like to concur with Professor Wilson. I think the context that we want to have this conversation in is one that does take a look at two different periods in American post-World War II history, that period post-World War II to about 1970 or so, when we saw both an increase in the standard of living for everybody, almost everybody in American society, at the same time that inequality was decreasing.
And that's both government policy, and that's a period of tremendous economic growth for an America unchallenged on the world economic stage.
That's the result of a tremendous 27-year period or so of economic boom and prosperity.
Are you saying that it's also a matter of government policy? Or
Yes, it is also a matter of government policy and a civil rights movement in the mid-1960s that helps to lower that inequality gap, and it's the result of other social movements as well.
So we're not alone.
Indeed,
but we're not standing alone and unchallenged on the economic stage by any means anymore.
Right.
So
where do we stand? The world changes as America experiences it somewhere in the early 1970s, and we see two things that start to change fairly dramatically. One is that unparalleled increase in the standard of living comes to a halt for most Americans.
Mm.
Right. So the standard of living automatic rise stops for most Americans.
Yep.
And secondly, we start to see an increase, a recrudescence, if you will, in inequality, a reversal from that earlier period. So we have the worst of both worlds, whereas before we had the best of both worlds. I think in both of those sets of time frames, that government policy plays a role as well as the economy.
We're going to come back, try and get a fix on where we stand now and where we might go. William Julius Wilson, Thomas Shapiro, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about American poverty and what to do about it. Beyond the Great Society and Republican Revolution, asking what will really work. You can join us. Did you see the third world face of Katrina's victims, the unvarnished poverty there? And why does this still exist in the world's richest country, in America? What should be done? What shouldn't be done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American poverty and what to do about it post-Katrina. I'm joined by William Julius Wilson of Harvard University. Thomas Shapiro of Brandeis is with us. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Lawrence Mead of New York University. You can join us as well. What do you think? If the war on poverty didn't solve it, and the market-based Republican Revolution hasn't worked, what next? What now? Is there a new approach, a new strategy? Would just paying attention be a good start? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm grateful to both of you for playing this through with us. We know we're not going to solve this, but we're trying to get a big fix on it. William Julius Wilson, you were straining at the bit there.
Yeah, I would just like to reinforce what Professor Shapiro was saying. If you look at this earlier period from the mid-1940s to early 1970s, in addition to economic growth, you also had social policies that included steady increases in the minimum wage. That's very, very important. A strong union movement that resulted in higher wages and wage increases and more non-wage benefits for ordinary workers. In other words, we had what the MIT economist Frank Levy called strong equalizing institutions.
A Republican might say, great, when we were on top of the world economically, now we've got competition and challenges all around. We can't necessarily afford to just do those things in a vacuum.
That's debatable. You know, it all depends on what you place as a part of your priorities. If you emphasize the need to address poverty, and if that's high on your priority list, you'll find money to pay for it.
You've pointed to job creation as the solution, Professor Wilson. But would anybody argue with that? I mean, good jobs are clearly a good answer to poverty, but how, you just can't snap your fingers and make them happen.
Well, obviously, you can't. I mean, we saw the positive effects of a strong economy, tight labor market in the latter 1990s, which significantly reduced poverty, joblessness.
It dipped on all fronts.
On all fronts. So we know that that's very important. How you bring that about, you know, what sort of macroeconomic policies you want to emphasize and monetary policies, that's a debatable question. All I know is that in that first period, a great deal of emphasis was placed on macroeconomic policies to promote tight labor markets or full employment.
Are you talking about bringing back the Great Society, or are you talking about that style of government intervention war on poverty, or are you trying to whisper in Alan Greenspan's ear here?
No, well, what I'm saying is that, you know, that there has to be a combination of factors in play here, both monetary policies, macroeconomic policies, to address the issue. Now, we don't have time to go into discussion of what these policies should be, but I would hope that monetary policy and macroeconomic policy could come together and be integrated in some way to promote economic growth and tight labor markets.
A way that works, and we're looking for that formula. Tom Shapiro, you've pointed to assets to chunks of wealth that are in some places and not in others. And you've looked in particular at the African-American community. Now, poverty, there are more poor whites in America than any other group, I suppose, in absolute figures. But in percentage terms, of course, African-Americans, Hispanics, much higher. What are you pointing to there? How do you accomplish that, getting more capital into the hands of the impoverished?
Well, I think one of the keys that we've been missing, in addition to a number of the other policies that are just as important, is thinking about a way of getting key financial assets into the hands of individuals and families to help them build a better life for themselves. Let me just give a quick context for this. Two out of every five American families do not have enough financial assets to survive 3 months at the government-defined poverty line if all streams of income were cut off.
In other words, it's hand-to-mouth.
In other words, it's hand-to-mouth. And that's some of what we're seeing in New Orleans, Mississippi, and Louisiana.
And the implications for that of getting out of poverty?
I think the implications are tremendous. I think that a stable middle-class existence in the United States is built on two pillars. One pillar is the job, occupation, human capital, living wage pillar that we're most familiar with and that needs to be much more attention in social policy in the future. That second pillar is the one we've missed. And that second pillar is about financial assets.
So what do you do? You're talking about giving?
No, I'm not talking about entitlements or giving people anything. If you don't mind, I'd like to take a minute or two to talk about some great social policies in the past that have facilitated wealth development among America's broad middle class.
We're all ears.
And let me just give you one quick example. One example is that two-thirds of the financial wealth of America's middle class is not money they've saved in savings accounts or stocks and bonds. It's in their home equity. It's the result of a fundamental institutional process that government facilitates through the Federal Housing Administration, through giving homeowners a huge tax break in the tax code on allowing us to deduct the interest on our home mortgage.
President Bush talks all the time about extending that to impoverished Americans and minorities.
Well, one of the issues there is that families need to come up with a down payment. They need to have financial assets to begin with.
And the poor don't have it, so they're cut out of the game, you're saying.
The poor are cut out of the game. And many American families, that's why I wanted to start with the context of two out of five American families are essentially asset poor.
So what, the government would spot them down payments to get them into the
come out of a period of about 10 years of experimentation and some national demonstration projects that demonstrate the validity and efficiency of what people call asset development policies. There has been, for example, a national demonstration program around individual development accounts, which is a mechanism where if families say they're going to put a relatively small amount of money into a defined savings account to buy a home, to get more education or skills for themselves,
specific things, not just cash flowing here,
not for the red convertible, then some entity, a foundation, government, state government, philanthropists will match it, sometimes at 100% a year interest. And that has proven to be a very effective mechanism that allows us now to make the statement that economists never would allow us to make in the past. Poor people can save. They can save when there is a certain set of institutional structures and incentives that allow them to do that. And they use that money for the kinds of purposes that most of us would agree with.
So match it in the way that a middle-class family's parents might help spot a young couple when they buy their first home. Be there in that kind of role.
In a very small fashion. It's not the same kind of transformative asset that kind of inheritance is, but it is
something.
Small amount of assets can leverage some fairly great changes when it's in the context of other kinds of policies.
So we've got William Julius Wilson saying, look at your macroeconomic policy, tighten up the labor market, get good jobs out there, and that's the way. Of course, that's easy to say, and as you point out, Professor Wilson, not necessarily easy to do, but you've got to aim at it if you want it. Tom Shapiro saying, let's jumpstart an asset foothold here for those in poverty. We've got that. I want to turn now to New York and Lawrence Mead, professor of politics at NYU. He's the author of The New Politics of Poverty, The Non-Working Poor in America and Beyond Entitlement. Lawrence Mead, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
So here we're looking out on this landscape in very public corners, unhappy landscape of poverty that we've seen after Katrina, trying to figure what to do about it. You hear the impulses of our two big thinkers in studio. We're looking for your angle as well. What is it?
Well, I agree with some of what I've heard. I agree that, first of all, the war on poverty did have some successes. It certainly reduced poverty among the elderly, and I would also say among the working age during the 60s and the early 70s. I also agree that inequality is rising among workers. That is clearly an issue. But I don't agree that inequality is the reason for poverty in most cases. The thing that no one has said is that most of the poor today in Louisiana and elsewhere are simply not employed. Only 36% of the poor recorded any earnings at all in 2003.
So are you laying that at Alan Greenspan's feet or at their own feet
and saying,
off your duff?
I wouldn't say either of those things. The lack of employment is something we really can't blame on the economy, because the economy at least is generating jobs, and we're being invaded by Mexico. Immigrants are flooding into the country to do jobs that Americans do not do. So the notion that jobs aren't available is not a plausible interpretation of what's going on.
So they should move out of New Orleans and go pick some strawberries.
Well, we need to get at the reasons for the lack of employment, and that's something we began to do successfully in the 90s, primarily in connection with welfare reform.
Now, what do you mean? You're talking about incentives? You think that the impoverished simply aren't properly incented to go out and get a job, whatever it pays?
It's not primarily a matter of incentives. We already have pretty strong incentives to work. It's rather that, for various reasons, people on welfare and other people who are poor tend not to work consistently.
Take the varnish off here. What are you saying? What do you mean, Mr. Mead?
Well, typically poor adults don't go into jobs and stay there for extended periods. They tend to drop in and out of the labor market primarily for reasons that have to do with their private lives. And the thing we need to do overwhelmingly to address poverty is to obtain steadier work effort on the part of poor adults, people on welfare, also people off welfare. We started to do that in the 90s by requiring welfare recipients to work and also by subsidizing them through wage subsidies, which no one's mentioned, plus a lot of other subsidies. This is a policy that I call help and hassle. We help you, but you also have to work. By addressing the work issue more directly, we began to have serious impact on poverty and on inequality. The trend towards inequality slowed sharply in the 90s because we had more people working, particularly at the bottom of society.
And you're saying that's because people were kind of pushed by policy.
They were pushed and they were helped both to move into steadier work. So the inequality question is there, but that primarily has to do with people who are employed. And you can't even really be unequal until you are a worker. It's among workers that we have inequality.
So are you making the behavior, the character argument here that the poor just simply don't have enough gumption?
I'm not going to say. The psychology is puzzling. I don't have a clear understanding of that. Really, nobody does. People want to work, but they tend not to work in practice.
And you're saying go out and get the jobs that Mexican immigrants are doing now.
Yeah, we have to require our poor adults to do the thing the immigrants are doing. Now, that doesn't solve everything. It doesn't mean that you attain adequate incomes necessarily. We have to do more to subsidize the incomes of people who are leaving welfare.
Those are not even necessarily incomes above the poverty line.
Well, they usually are if people work steady hours and claim remaining benefits like food stamps and the earned income tax credit. So there's no reason to remain in poverty if you are employed and you work serious previous hours and you claim remaining benefits. So we already have a policy for escaping poverty that doesn't address every question. The inequality issue remains, but inequality is not the cause of poverty. Mostly that's due to lack of all employment.
Lawrence Mead, hold that thought. William Julius Wilson, I'd love your take on this. Lawrence Mead says go out and take the jobs that are there. Don't wait for immigrants to take them. Whatever they pay, go get them. And inequality is not the issue anyway.
It is an issue, but a different issue.
Not the issue,
Well, you know, what really struck me when I was looking at recent statistics is that during the economic boom period of the late 1990s, the poverty rate dropped sharply, but also the jobless rate dropped, a significant increase in employment, even in some of the inner city areas. The jobless rate in inner city areas dropped significantly across the country. I'm thinking of a recent study that showed that black males ages 16 to 24 without a high school education, many of them with prison records, were working more, earning higher wages, and committing far fewer crimes than in the early 1990s. And that was because of a tight labor market situation, a situation where employers were looking for workers rather than workers looking for employers.
But what do you say to Lawrence Mead's recipe here? Go and get the jobs that immigrants are doing. Compete with them, no matter how low the wages. Take those jobs, and if you do enough of that work, you'll work your way out of poverty. Maybe not far, but out.
It is not the case that people are not taking jobs that that the immigrants are taking. In fact, what's happening in many cases is that immigrants are displacing a lot of domestic workers. One of the reasons that black males have such a high jobless rate is that immigrants and women have entered the labor market in significant numbers and have displaced them.
But if they would, if anyone would work for the same wages under the same circumstances, it sounds draconian. But is there a solution there? Are people just too holding out for too high a wage, even if it's barely above poverty?
Well, let me just say this.
Yes, sir.
For most domestic workers, dead-end menial jobs are really difficult to hold on and maintain. There's a built-in turnover rate for those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could make work pay, if we could sort of subsidize income and provide more fringe benefits, I think you would get workers staying in these jobs for a longer period of time.
I want to begin to bring our callers in, if I may. Jose is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Jose, you're on the air.
Yes. First of all, I don't hear any of you guys mention anything about outsourcing and plant closings and steel mill going, you know, going kaplooey. You know,
I think that's Professor Wilson's point. But yes, jobs just going away.
Yeah. I mean, that has to increase poverty to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, and he's right. You know, from the up under Roosevelt, not only did Johnson declare war on poverty, but in a sense, Roosevelt did too with his Social Security program. And the Republicans are always talking about how social programs don't work. Where the market force is not the answer to everything either.
So what should we do, Jose?
Well, we should invest in our people. That's what we should do. If you don't, if people are the main resource, if you don't invest in them, you don't invest in that, and that, then we're going to have abject poverty for infinitum.
Jose, thanks very much for your call. Tom Shapiro?
Jose, thank you very much. Let me see if I can connect one of your concerns to a point that Professor Wilson was making. I think looking at the labor market situation in the late 1990s is indeed very instructive because it helps us to see through a question about the behavior of poverty people in the United States.
Boom time, poverty dipping, what do you see there?
And whether they're looking for jobs. Mm-hmm. I think the key is not so much to a discussion about whether the poor are willing to work, but rather what the late 1990s and other periods of time in contrast helps to show us is that it depends on what kinds of conditions, what the wages look like, what the benefits look like, what the conditions of the return on their investment in that labor looks
Lawrence
like.
Lawrence Mead says, don't be so picky. Well, go get the jobs that are there.
Well, I think that a lot of individuals make rational decisions based on what they think their stakes are at a particular point in time.
Well,
and I'm not sure that I want people just to be, you know, I'm sorry for the characterization, but just picking strawberries at minimum wage.
Mr. Mead, it does sound kind of hard-hearted and barely a solution.
No, I'm not saying, first of all, most people who go to work in low-wage jobs go to work above the minimum wage. Minimum wage is characteristic mostly of secondary workers who are not themselves poor. They're in families where they have other income. I'm not saying the jobs are necessarily adequate. I'm saying they're enough to escape poverty. And we shouldn't attribute the poverty problem primarily to structural problems in the economy. Mm. That really isn't plausible given the fact that jobs are readily available.
We'll come back and look at that, but Jose reminds us jobs are also leaving. We're looking at American poverty and what to do about it with Lawrence Mead, Thomas Shapiro, and William Julius Wilson. You can join us. Where's the cutting edge here? Government, private business, home and family. And what's the way, the mindset, the work to be done that might actually take on poverty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American poverty and what to do about it post-Katrina, looking beyond the Great Society, beyond Republican Revolution, and asking what will really work here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I've been joined from New York University by Lawrence Mead, from Brandeis by Thomas Shapiro, and from Harvard's Kennedy School by William Julius Wilson. You can join us as well. Charles is on the line from Germantown, Maryland. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you?
We're well. What do you think?
Well, my first thing is, the first thing that prompted me to call is the language that you guys are using. I find it to be really imprecise, and maybe, you know, you're saying something that you're not saying what you really want to say.
It's hard, it's broad, it's a big question, but where do you want to get more focused, Charles?
Well, the issue is, when you're saying economic inequality, that's really not the issue. In a capitalist society, you're always going to have some people that are wealthier than others. The problem really is the people at the bottom of or at the end of the food chain here, and we don't want to see, you know, these people, you know, in this society on our TV set.
So how do you fix it? And it's not just a question, I hope, of hiding them off the TV.
Well, it's just kind of struck me as ridiculous that, you know, when we saw the pictures from New Orleans, it's like everybody, you know, it seems like the whole country was, oh my God, there's poverty in the United States. Like, it, you know, it hasn't been there all along. And the way to fix it is by really developing a system where everybody at least has the opportunity to climb out of the holes that they've either been born into or find themselves into.
Sure. So how?
Well, the problem is taxes. I mean, the country, the people that really have an impact on the political system of this country, you know, are abhorred by the notion of higher taxes. And in the European countries that have more progressive governments, you know, people pay higher taxes.
So you're saying go for that, raise the taxes and redistribute some of the wealth, and we'll be on our way.
It's going to be a long ways farther along than we are now.
But there's a beginning, and we've got it, Charles. I thank you for that call. I want to get another caller here right away, if I may. Judy is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes.
I couldn't agree more with the last caller. It seems to me that the statistics have been there, the information has been there, and we're only seeing it now because it's on the TV screen. And it also seems to me that all the tax cuts, this trickle-down theory, has been proven wrong in a big, big way. And I wish we would look at that and examine it and see that all that's happening is we're removing the ability for these people to get themselves out of poverty. A lot of the people we saw on TV were disabled and had health issues, and the schools in New Orleans are known to be awful. And the more we cut the federal taxes, the more vulnerable the local level becomes and the harder it gets for them.
But what about the Republican argument? If you raise taxes, you're going to hit economic growth. You've got less growth. You've got fewer jobs.
Yeah, but all that's happened is the dollar amount of wealth has grown, but the poverty level has grown too.
Lawrence Mead says, and you heard him, to have people go out and get the jobs that are there, even if they stink.
Yeah, but if somebody is disabled and has no health care and there's no health coverage with that job, how are they going to perform in the job?
But you know, not every person in poverty is disabled by any means.
No, absolutely. A lot of them have bad education. A lot of them are becoming people who are too old because they're over 50, and now they're less desirable than somebody they can hire at a younger rate.
Yep. Judy, we've got it, and thanks for your call. William Julius Wilson.
I would like to question the argument that jobs are readily available. Depends on what sector you're in, what location you're in. The availability of jobs varies significantly across the nation. I think that Katrina exposed the most glaring aspects of the rising inequality that I was talking about.
But callers are pushing back on inequality,
issue. No, we should not lose sight of the fact that the extremely high levels of concentrated poverty cannot be separated from trends that are adversely affecting large segments of the American population, including the decreased relative demand for low-skilled labor caused by the computer revolution and the growing internationalization of economic activity.
So Judy says, educate people, support them where they're weak, make them essentially make them competitive in the global
market. I could not agree with her more.
So, how do you do? Do you have to raise taxes to do that?
Of course, I strongly agree with her argument that that we need to look at the tax policies.
The GOP would say that will cut economic growth and bite right back on itself.
I think that those policies are going to be re-examined very shortly.
Because the population is going to require it. Lawrence Mead, what do you say?
I'm not taking a stand on the question of whether taxes should be higher or lower.
Really?
Spending. No, I don't think that is centrally related to the poverty question.
But taxes do pay for education. They do pay for job training.
But that we're already spending a lot of money subsidizing poor workers, which I favor. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do more of that. If we had to do that, we might have to raise taxes. But the idea that that the poverty question is all of a piece with the broader partisan question about the role of government, that simply isn't true. Even in the 90s, when the Bush administration was cutting a very conservative posture on many issues, they were spending money wholesale on welfare reform and all the associated subsidies. We have not adapted a small government policy in pursuing anti-poverty in the 90s.
So you're saying the market-driven talk hasn't been followed with the walk?
The market-driven talk is important for some areas of policy, particularly macroeconomic governance of the economy. I'm not saying that's not an important question, but that isn't the policy that we pursued in the 90s. The 90s was a combination of reliance on a tight labor market with heavy enforcement of work for the welfare poor and subsidies for them and other low-wage workers. Subsidies paid for by public money, and that was not controversial. Even conservatives favored this because the evidence strongly showed that we needed to combine work enforcement with work subsidies in order for people to escape poverty.
Let us look at that, if we may. Tom Shapiro, William Julius Wilson says we didn't let the Great Society work its entire way. Lawrence Mead says we talked markets, but we really had an awful lot of government going on there. So where does that leave us? Where are we? What does it all suggest?
Well, I think it suggests that there are a lot of different perspectives to take on the issue of poverty per se. Not only is that obvious, but we as a society have to think through where the successes have been and what the causes and sources of those successes have been. And I would go back to I think everybody here agrees with the profound success of the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, in helping workers get out of poverty.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. I think we should have a goal that where there is a living wage, where we don't, as a society, need to support people who are working full time in that way.
So raise the wages so you don't have to come back with the earned income tax credit.
That would be one approach. I'm also very much an advocate of thinking through policies that don't just help poor people to survive, to not go homeless, to have clothes on their back and not go hungry, but the kinds of policies that can really help push individuals, families, and communities forward in a way that their departure from poverty will become more permanent, more stable, and self-reliant.
Is that the government or is that the market that pushes that?
That has to do, I think, with institutions and government structuring incentives for families to build key assets for themselves.
And that's where you were before. Come in behind them with a little support. Brooke is calling from Flint Hill, Virginia. Brooke, you're on the air.
Hi.
I
was hoping to refute the gentleman who was talking about minimum wage jobs and how you could actually get out of poverty on a minimum wage job or even more than one. It's he's very mistaken, and I'm assuming, of course, that you've never had a minimum wage job, but you can't. I'm very, very fortunate. I'm the working poor. I'm a single mother. I have two jobs,
Neither
of which pays minimum wage. They pay fairly well, and I'm barely making it. Save money. I can't buy a house.
Lawrence Mead, speak to Brooke.
Her situation is more typical. I'm not saying that people should support themselves on the minimum wage. As I mentioned, a few poor adults actually go to work at the minimum wage. They go to work, like this woman, at usually above that. I'm not saying they have an easy time.
But you said go and take the jobs that immigrants are now taking, and some of those, many of those are minimum wage, and some are worse.
I don't believe that that's typically true. If you were to ask what the immigrants are earning, you'd probably find it's a couple dollars above the minimum wage. Again, I'm not saying that's sufficient. The question of equality among workers is an important question, but that's largely a separate question from poverty, which has to do with working at some job, steadily.
But isn't that a recipe for the status quo, Lawrence? I mean, you're saying go get the jobs that are already there. Well,
no.
So what's
quite
new?
Quite the contrary. It's exactly by taking those jobs and entering into the labor force, perhaps joining trade unions, voting for left-wing parties. It's exactly by joining the economy that poor people acquire the leverage to move things to the left if they want. I believe that's already started to happen. As we move people into the labor force in the 90s, on social policy anyway, even the Bush administration started talking a more liberal line.
Well,
it's popular to help workers who are helping themselves.
William Julius Wilson, Lawrence Mead wants to put the shoe right back on the foot of the poor, as I hear. So go get a job, and then you'll be on the escalator.
Yeah, as I said before, job availability varies significantly. Right now, I think it's safe to say that we have a slack labor market with fairly high levels of unemployment, relatively speaking. And when you have slack labor markets, people have difficulty finding jobs, and I just want to underline that point.
So go and find them wherever they are, Lawrence Mead might say. You say that's unrealistic?
Actually, there is the census asks people who are not working what the reason is, and very few of them say is that they can't find work. They usually say they can find work, but they're not working due to various other factors, family responsibilities, health questions, or they're retired. They're going to school.
Well, we can't just leave it at that, Tom Shapiro. We've got a minute here. Where do we go?
With Lawrence Mead's comment, I think that's precisely the place that we think about connecting social policy to the marketplace in a way where we think about ways of providing the structures that will allow people to work full or part-time in a way that makes it work for them. Things like child care, things like continued support of EITC, things like community development, etc.
So here's a kind of bridge between great society and all market. You're saying you've got to have something smart in between the two.
I think so.
Well, we are not going to solve this today. That's clear. I hope we've got a little better fix on the big parameters. Thomas Shapiro from Brandeis University, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for letting me share some of my ideas.
And Lawrence Mead at New York University, very glad to have you. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
William Julius Wilson, we're going to have you back and dig in even further. We're grateful for your time today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
William Julius Wilson, author of When Work Disappears. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, politics and a new Georgia poll tax. This is On Point.
In a speech from New Orleans 2 weeks ago, President Bush spoke of the, quote, history of racial discrimination which cut off generations from the opportunity of America. But racial discrimination is not history.
On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly.
Discrimination lives in Georgia, where the Republican legislature has enacted a new poll tax. To prove their identities at the polls, voters without driver's licenses must obtain state-issued photo IDs costing $20 to $35. Georgia has 159 counties, but the IDs are purchasable at only 56 locations. These do not include Atlanta, with its high concentration of African Americans, the elderly, and the poor. Even supposing they had the ready cash to buy a license to vote, how will city residents get to the ID-issuing offices? As New Orleans revealed and census data confirms, blacks are three times less likely than whites to own or have access to cars. The bill's Republican supporters say the law is necessary to combat voter fraud. But Georgia's Secretary of State, a Democrat, testified that in 9 years in office, she had not come across a single documented case of voter impersonation. Black disfranchisement, the NAACP plausibly charges, is the law's real objective. And with the ACLU and other groups, it has sued Georgia in federal court for violating the 24th Amendment banning the poll tax, one of the devices used to drive blacks and poor whites out of the southern electorate after Reconstruction. A month before the president consigned racial discrimination to, quote, history, his attorney general approved Georgia's new poll tax, lending the, quote, national to what the New York Times calls, quote, this national disgrace.
On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, he joins me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, with more. Jack, so we're talking about poverty for an hour. You come on and remind us that we have something some are calling a poll tax, actually building another wall between the poor and empowerment.
Yes, and it's a sort of return of the repressed. We've been this route before, beginning with Mississippi in 1890, ending with Oklahoma in 1910, southern states adopted new constitutions that really disfranchised blacks. They used poll taxes, registration requirements, and literacy tests to achieve the result. Ironically, this was energized by elite anxiety over the white-black politics of class introduced into the South by the populist. And so the idea was to drive down black registration. For example, in Louisiana, it went down from 93% in 1896 to 1.1% in 1904. But also poor whites were lost out. In South Carolina, half of all white voters lost their right to vote when the black man lost his. So we had an anti-democracy movement about 100 years ago that effectively drove poor whites and blacks out of the southern electorate, with the result that the average voter turnout for the period 20 years before about 1896 in the South was about 65%. Mm. From 1924 to 1948, the turnout was 24%. That's how effective these devices were.
So we're looking at poverty this hour. We have been. Are you really saying that what's going on here is not an addressing of poverty, but a kind of a retrogression to just cutting people off from power, pushing them back down?
Well, I don't see any other way to read this, given the testimony of the Georgia Secretary of State that voter impersonation is not a problem in Georgia. And, you know, the fact that that Atlanta does not have one of these places where you can get one of these IDs, that the six counties with the highest percentage of blacks and Latinos, they don't have a place where you can go and get one. This is pretty, seems to me, substantial, circumstantial evidence that the real intention is just to drive black turnout and poor turnout down.
One state's step. Let's hope it's not the national step. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.